In this day. Well, good evening. Tonight we continue in this chapter on knowledge by identity and separative knowledge. It's chapter 10 in the second book of the Life Divine. And we are now in the midst of the celebration in India of Navaratri, which is, you might say, an annual call for the Divine Mother to answer the call, the plea of Earth, to relieve her of the weight of darkness and ignorance. And so, she who was difficult, Durga, summoning all her powers, comes and confronts the being who represents the ego, the asura, and on the day of victory, strikes him down. This we must do from season to season, from year to year, because until there is a vast change in the consciousness of the human, it will be necessary for us to wrestle with light and darkness. But until then, light will prevail. That ancient adage in Sanskrit from the tradition of the Veda, let us say, Satyam eva varte. Verily, the truth wins. Truth conquers. And on that day, when she confronts Mahishasura, even though he seems gigantic, larger than she, still, that demon is falling back when he confronts her power, because she is conscious power. And even in manifestation, as she draws her bow, as she raises her trident, whatever her instrument of choice, her eye goes upwards to reach back to the summits of her own being, to summon that force, and to strike down that darkness with the power of light. We see this image again and again in spiritual literature, where the victory is one of light over darkness, one of consciousness over unconsciousness, of knowledge over ignorance. And since we're in this chapter, knowledge by identity, she goes there, drawing on her own being, Swayambhu, and comes back here to destroy what is separative, figured in the ego. I think you'll forgive me for taking a moment to express that. So, to continue with our chapter, there are four kinds of knowledge which Sri Aurobindo defined at the beginning of the chapter. Knowledge by identity. Then, knowledge by direct contact. Knowledge by separative direct contact. And separative indirect knowledge acquires its own kind of knowledge. Separative indirect contact acquires its own kind of knowledge. I think we're in a section here discussing knowledge by direct contact. Let us proceed. We've just come out of him recalling to us the image of those two walls that divide us from our own inner being and from the outer world, and how those things can be dissolved. He continues here. This affiliation, this concealed method of our knowledge, obscure and non-evident to our present mentality, becomes clear and evident when the subliminal inner being breaks its boundaries of individuality and, carrying our surface mind with it, enters into the cosmic consciousness. The subliminal is separated from the cosmic through a limitation by the subtler sheaths of our being, its mental, vital, subtle, physical sheaths, just as the surface nature is separated from universal nature by the gross physical sheath, the body. But the circumscribing wall around it is more transparent, is indeed less a wall than a fence. Beautiful phrasing here. So he's describing, as the subliminal merges into the cosmic, it is composed of a number of sheaths which are projected into the circumconscient, which connects outwards to the world. The subliminal has, besides, a formation of consciousness which projects itself beyond all these sheaths and forms a circumconscient, an environing part of itself through which it receives the contacts of the world, and they become and can become aware of them and deal with them before they enter. The subliminal is able to widen indefinitely this circumconscient envelope and more enlarge its self-projection into the cosmic existence around it. So the circumconscient envelope can expand. A point comes where it can break through the separation altogether, unite, identify itself with cosmic being, feel itself universal, one with all existence. In this freedom of entry into cosmic self and cosmic nature, there is a great liberation of the individual being. It puts on a cosmic consciousness, becomes the universal individual. Its first result, when it is complete, is the realization of the cosmic spirit, the one self inhabiting the universe. And this union may even bring about a disappearance of the sense of individuality, a merger of the ego into the world being. This is virtually Upanishadic in its vision. Another common result is an entire openness to the universal energy, so that it is felt acting through the mind and life and body, and the sense of individual action ceases. But more usually, there are results of less amplitude. There is a direct awareness of universal being and nature. There is a greater openness of the mind to the cosmic mind and its energies, to the cosmic life and its energies, to cosmic matter and its energies. A certain sense of unity of the individual with the cosmic, a perception of the world held within one's consciousness as well as of one's own intimate inclusion in the world consciousness, can become frequent or constant in this opening. A greater feeling of unity with other beings is its natural consequence. It is then that the existence of the cosmic being becomes a certitude and a reality, and is no longer an ideative perception. So the results of this movement towards unification, first a movement into the cosmic realization, then acquisition of universal energies, what we would identify as the various powers of siddhi, of fulfillment, which ancient Indian occultism speaks about in yoga practice. We would experience an expanded awareness and access to pranic powers, which are normally beyond our reach. We would feel individual unity with the cosmos, a merging of self into the cosmos, a feeling that the cosmos exists within oneself. Absent the sense of individuality, these cosmic forces move through us as if choosing this instrument as a vehicle of its larger expression. But we can have the sense of continuity within that, and we'll get to that. He continues here, but the cosmic consciousness of things is founded upon knowledge by identity. Back to that. For the universal spirit knows itself as the self of all, knows all as itself and in itself, knows all nature as part of its nature. It is one with all that it contains, and knows it by that identity and by a containing nearness. For there is, at the same time, an identity and an exceeding. And while from the point of view of the identification there is a oneness and complete knowledge, so from the point of view of the exceeding there is an inclusion and a penetration, an enveloping cognition of each thing and all things, a penetrating sense and vision of each thing and all things. For the cosmic spirit inhabits each and all, but is more than all. There is, therefore, in its self-view and world-view, a separative power which prevents the cosmic consciousness from being imprisoned in the objects and beings in which it dwells. It dwells within them as an all-pervading spirit and power. Whatever individualization takes place is proper to the person or object, but is not binding on the cosmic being. It becomes each thing without ceasing from its own larger all-containing existence. Here, then, is a large universal identity containing smaller identities. For whatever separative cognition exists in or enters into the cosmic consciousness must stand on this double identity and does not contradict it. If there is any need of a drawing back and a knowledge by separation plus contact, it is yet a separateness in identity, a contact in identity. For the object contained is part of the self, of that which contains it. So we see here an enveloping, a penetrating power that becomes more the rule rather than the exception. When this is given up, it is because the sharp need is felt to obtain separateness for the cosmic plane. It is, as he says here, it is only when a more drastic separativeness intervenes that the identity veils itself and throws up a lesser knowledge, direct or indirect, which is unaware of its source. Yet is it always the sea of identity which throws up to the surface the waves or the spray of a direct or an indirect knowledge. This is on the side of consciousness. On the side of action, of the cosmic energies, it is seen that they move in masses, waves, currents, constantly constituting and reconstituting beings and objects, movements and happenings, entering into them, passing through them, forming themselves in them, throwing themselves out from them on other beings and objects. So we move from the absorption in chit into the expression of chit shakti, conscious power. Each natural individual is a receptacle of these cosmic forces and a dynamo for their propagation. there passes from each to each a constant stream of mental and vital energies, and these run too in cosmic waves and currents no less than the forces of physical nature. All this action is veiled from our surface mind's direct sense and knowledge, but it is known and felt by the inner being, though only through a direct contact. When the being enters into the cosmic consciousness, it is still more widely, inclusively, intimately aware of this play of cosmic forces. But although the knowledge is then more complete, the dynamization of this knowledge can only be partial. For while a fundamental or static unification with the cosmic self is possible, the active dynamic unification with cosmic nature must be incomplete. On the level of mind and life, even with the loss of the sense of a separate self-existence, the energisms must be in their very nature a selection through individualization. The action is that of the cosmic energy, but the individual formation of it in the living dynamo remains the method of its working. For the very use of the dynamo of individuality is to select, to concentrate and formulate selected energies and throw them out in formed and canalized currents. The flow of a total energy would mean that this dynamo had no further use, could be abolished or put out of action. Instead of an activity of individual mind, life, body, there would be only an individual but impersonal center or channel through which the universal forces would flow unimpeded and unselected. This can happen, but it would imply a higher spiritualization far exceeding the normal mental level. So as long as the specific evolved individual is necessary, then that much sense of separation must be present. But there is this greater possibility of the instrument in which, while retaining its individual character and point or aperture of openness through which these cosmic energies could pour, this is a level of such high spiritualization that it is not ordinarily achieved even by people who live in the sense actively of the cosmic consciousness. Sri Aurobindo is being modest here because you can see in his recorded notes about himself that he lived in that state. In the static seizure of the cosmic knowledge by identity, the subliminal universalized may feel itself one with the cosmic self and the secret self of all others, but the dynamization of that knowledge would not go farther than a translation of this sense of identity into a greater power and intimacy of direct contact of consciousness with all, a greater, more intimate, more powerful and efficient impact of the force of consciousness on things and persons, a capacity, too, of an effective inclusion and penetration of a dynamized intimate vision and feeling and other powers of cognition and action proper to this larger nature. So you can see the fluidity, the lessening of rigid walls separating movement within, movement from out inside, movement into another, movement of that other into oneself. In the subliminal, therefore, even enlarged into the cosmic consciousness, we get a greater knowledge, but not the complete and original knowledge. So, even if we take this subliminal opening, this awakening to our inner nature, our inhabiting the circumconscient, our mastery of the subliminal, feeling no more that there are walls separating us from self and from world, we come to know ourselves better, we come to feel the world more intimately. Still, we have not got back to an absolute knowledge. Even when we feel that we are in constant direct commerce with the cosmos, he says now, to go farther and see what the knowledge by identity is in its purity, and in what way and to what extent it originates, admits, or uses the other powers of knowledge, we have to go beyond the inner mind and life and subtle physical to the two other ends of the subliminal, interrogate the subconscient, and contact or enter into the superconscient. The subliminal, as we have come to discuss it here, refers to the inner mind, the inner life, the inner physicality that we have, because our outer mind is a piecemeal expression of what our inner mind is, and it's much larger being. The little bit of our life that gets expressed outside is only a jet and an eddy from that larger current of life which is in us. And this little physicality that we experience such dismaying decay in is itself an imperfect reflection of a far greater instrument which lies within, in what we call the sukshma sharira in Sanskrit. So to get to the real nature of what is this knowledge by identity, we have to go beyond this inner nature to basically a higher nature. We have to get to the superconscient. And we must dive down further below physicality into the subconscient to understand what these two poles, superconscient and subconscient, can tell us about the origination of knowledge by identity. So, knowledge by identity unites the above with the below. And we are looking for that unity. But, he writes, in the subconscient, all is blind, an obscure universalism such as is seen in the mass consciousness, an obscure individualism, either abnormal to us or ill-formed and instinctive. Here in the subconscient, a dark knowledge by identity, such as we find already in the inconscience, is the basis, but it does not reveal itself and its secret. The superior superconscient ranges are based upon the spiritual consciousness, free and luminous, and it is there that we can trace the original power of knowledge and perceive the origin and difference of the two distinct orders, knowledge by identity and separative knowledge. Back to the title of the chapter. In the supreme timeless existence, as far as we know it by reflection and spiritual experience, existence and consciousness are one. Sat and Chit are the same. We are accustomed to identify consciousness with certain operations of mentality and sense, and where these are absent or quiescent, we speak of that state of being as unconscious. But consciousness can exist where there are no overt operations, no signs revealing it, even where it is withdrawn from objects and absorbed in pure existence, or involved in the appearance of non-existence. It is intrinsic in being, self-existent, swayambhum, not abolished by quiescence, by inaction, by veiling or covering, by inert absorption or involution. It is there in the being, even when its state seems to be dreamless sleep or a blind trance or an annulment of awareness or an absence. So in all of these states, the self-existent being, Swayambhu, as in Katha Upanishad at the beginning of the chapter, as also in the Isha Upanishad in the seventh verse, this is the nature of that self-existent consciousness, always present in all states, however variegated, however unexpressed. In the supreme timeless status, where consciousness is one with being and immobile, it is not a separate reality, but simply and purely the self-awareness inherent in existence. There is no need of knowledge, nor is there any operation of knowledge. Being is self-evident to itself. It does not need to look at itself in order to know itself or learn that it is. Being is self-evident to itself. This is the chit of sat, not different from. But if this is evidently true of pure existence, it is also true of the primal all existence. For just as spiritual self-existence is intrinsically aware of itself, so it is intrinsically aware of all that is in its being. This is not by an act of knowledge formulated in a self-regard, a self-observation, but by the same inherent awareness. It is intrinsically all conscious of all that is by the very fact that all is itself. Thus, conscious of its timeless self-existence, the spirit, the being, is aware in the same way, intrinsically, absolutely, totally, without any need of a look or act of knowledge, because it is all of time existence and of all that is in time. This is the essential awareness by identity. If applied to cosmic existence, it would mean an essential, self-evident, automatic consciousness of universe by the spirit, because it is everything and everything is its being. But there is another status of spiritual awareness, which seems to us to be a development from the state and power of pure consciousness, perhaps even a first departure, but is in fact normal and intimate to it. For the awareness by identity is always the very stuff of all the spirit self-knowledge, but it admits within itself, without changing or modifying its own eternal nature, a subordinate and simultaneous awareness by inclusion and by indwelling. The being, the self-existent, Swayambhu, sees all existences in its one existence. It contains them all and knows them as being of its being, consciousness of its consciousness, power of its power, bliss of its bliss. It is at the same time necessarily the self in them and knows all in them by its pervadingly indwelling selfness. But still, all this awareness exists intrinsically, self-evidently, automatically, without the need of any act, regard, or operation of knowledge. For knowledge here is not an act, but a state pure, perpetual, and inherent. At the base of all spiritual knowledge is this consciousness of identity and by identity, which knows or is simply aware of all as itself. Translated into our way of consciousness, this becomes the triple knowledge thus formulated in the Upanishad. He who sees all existences in the self, he who sees the self in all existences, He in whom the self has become all existences, inclusion, indwelling, and identity. But in the fundamental consciousness, this seeing is a spiritual self-sense, a seeing that is self-light of being, not a separative regard or a regard upon self, turning that self into object. By the way, this is Isha Upanishad 6 and 7. But in this fundamental self-experience, a regard of consciousness can manifest, which, though inherently possible, an inevitably self-contained power of spirit is not a first active element of the absorbed intrinsic self-luminousness and self-evidence of the Supreme Consciousness. This regard belongs to or brings in another status of the Supreme Spiritual Consciousness, a status in which knowledge as we know it begins. There is a state of consciousness, and in it, intimate to it, there is an act of knowing. The spirit regards itself. It becomes the knower and the known. In a way, the subject and object, or rather the subject-object in one of its own self-knowledge. But this regard, this knowledge, is still intrinsic, still self-evident, an act of identity. There is no beginning of what we experience as separate of knowledge. But when the subject draws back, but when the subject draws a little back from itself as object, then certain tertiary powers of spiritual knowledge, of knowledge by identity, take their first origin, which are the sources of our normal modes of knowledge. And yes, if you are hearing here overtones or connotations of what he has discussed in his explanation of what are the various levels of the supramental consciousness, including the secondary and tertiary. The three statuses are described in the triple status of supermind in chapter 16. Yes, this is impacting the lines which he is composing here, years and decades later. To continue, there is a spiritual intimate vision, a spiritual pervasive entry and penetration, a spiritual feeling in which one sees all as oneself, feels all as oneself, contacts all as oneself. There is a power of spiritual perception of the object and all that it contains or is, perceived in an enveloping and pervading identity, the identity itself constituting the perception. There is a spiritual conception that is the original substance of thought, not the thought that discovers the unknown, but that which brings out the intrinsically known from oneself and places it in self-space, in an extended being of self-awareness, as an object of conceptual self-knowledge. There is a spiritual emotion, a spiritual sense. There is an intermingling of oneness with oneness, of being with being, of consciousness with consciousness, of delight of being with delight of being. There is a joy of intimate separateness in identity, of relations of love joined with love in a supreme unity, a delight of the many powers, truths, beings of the eternal oneness, of the forms of the formless. All the play of the becoming in the being founds its self-expression upon these powers of the consciousness of the spirit. But in their spiritual origin, all these powers are essential, not instrumental, not organized, devised, or created. They are the luminous, self-aware substance of the spiritual identical, made active on itself and in itself. Spirit made sight. Spirit vibrant as feeling. Spirit self-luminous as perception and conception. All is in fact the knowledge by identity. Self-powered, self-moving in its multitudinous selfhood of one awareness. The Spirit's infinite self-experience moves between sheer identity and a multiple identity, a delight of intimately differentiated oneness and an absorbed self-rapture. I think that is an appropriate place to end for this evening. Next week, we finish our chapter. But tonight, we continue with Savitri. Luminous lines drawn from the Book of the Divine Mother. Book 3. Canto 3, The House of the Spirit and the New Creation. Then suddenly there came a downward look, as if a sea exploring its own depths, a living oneness widened at its core and joined him to unnumbered multitudes, a bliss, a light, a power, a flame-white love, caught all into a soul-immense embrace. Existence found its truth on oneness' breast, and each became the self and space of all. The great world rhythms were heartbeats of one soul. To feel was a flame discovery of God. All mind was a single harp of many strings, all life a song of many meeting lines. For worlds were many, but the self was one. This knowledge now was made a cosmos seed. This seed was cased in the safety of the light. It needed not a sheath of ignorance. Then, from the trance of that tremendous clasp, and from the throbbings of that single heart, and from the naked spirit's victory, a new and marvelous creation rose. Incalculable outflowing infinitudes, laughing out an unmeasured happiness, lived their innumerable unity. Worlds where the being is unbound and wide, bodied unthinkably the egoless self. Rapture of beatific energies joined time to the timeless, poles of a single joy. White vasts were seen where all is wrapped in all. There were no contraries, no sundered parts. All by spiritual links were joined to all and bound indissolubly to the one. Each was unique, but took all lives as his own, and following out these tones of the infinite, recognized in himself the universe. A splendid center of infinity's whirl, pushed to its zenith's height, its last expanse, felt the divinity of its own self-bliss, repeated in its numberless other selves. It took up tirelessly into its scope persons and figures of the impersonal, as if prolonging in a ceaseless count, in a rapturous multiplication sum, the recurring decimals of eternity. Namaste. Jai Mom.